Maybe there's another way to do this.
Maybe there is. In any event, welcome along to our Human Non-Human Relations podcast, number 30. Yeah, so welcome along to on Human Non-Human Relations podcast number 30, and for this issue I'm in conversation with Professor Oscar Horta, philosopher and anti-speciesist activist, currently the Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Oscar's research explores various issues surrounding the moral consideration of other animals by humans. He's written lots and lots of articles and papers about speciesism, bioethics, egalitarianism, and related issues. So, I mainly wanted to talk to Oscar about the points that were raised in a Veggie Pride address he did earlier this year, as you'll see from the interview. So, on with the show, as we say. So, Oscar, I want to welcome you to my podcast. Welcome along. I hope you're well.
Thanks a lot. I'm fine. I hope you are well too, Roger.
Yeah, I'm struggling through. Here in sunny Dublin, we're struggling away, but we're doing okay. I saw the 56-minute or so speech you did at the Veggie Pride 2013 event, which I think was in May of this year. And you were talking about strategies, and I found some of the stuff that you talked about was very interesting, very useful, and also in some senses quite challenging. So I wanted to see if we can tease out in the time we have some of the points that you raised. For example, you talked about a series of cognitive biases. We could talk about that. You were talking about the rejection of speciesism, and your position being anti-speciesist. You were talking about that is kind of a move beyond just being opposed to being vegan, which is quite an interesting thing. You were talking about the suboptimal courses of action. Mm-hmm. You talked about the need to be bold enough to rethink everything. So it was a kind of appeal for reflexivity. And then you talked about intervention in nature, which is an interesting thing. You talked about R selection and K selection, these kind of issues. And then finally, you had some very good advice for spokespersons everywhere. When you talked about the media, when you said that you know, some people think that when they go on a media interview, their job is to answer the questions, yeah. Whereas you were saying, no, don't do that, just make the points, you know, yeah. make 3 points and do them 3 times.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to this cognitive biases, then, yeah. you went through a number of them. Can you just give us a broad kind of overview of what you were saying?
Yeah, well, the thing is that we all have cognitive biases. I mean, psychologists have known these for a long time, and there are a huge number of them. I mean, if you Google cognitive bias in the internet, you'll find that there are lots of them. But there are some that are especially important for us to discover and to try to avoid, because they affect the way in which we assess how effective we can be in helping animals, and more than that, how efficient we are. Because the concept of efficiency really is important here. Because when we talk about effectiveness, we talk about how we achieve our aims. But when we talk about efficiency, we talk about something different, which is how good we are at maximizing how effective we are with the resources we have. Because, there are many successful campaigns that we can reach, that we can develop, but the level to which they are successful can vary, right? We can do something and make it possible that, I don't know, 10 people or 20 people go vegan and start to question speciesism, but maybe if with the same resources we did something different, we would not have, achieved this, but maybe we could have achieved that 100 people ended up being vegan and questioning speciesism and so on. So that's why it's so important to learn about these cognitive biases. So, for instance, we have, I mean, well, in this talk you mentioned before, I mean, I tackle many of them, but I don't think we have the time to explain them all. So I'll just mention a very few ones. So, for instance, we have a tendency of focusing towards our immediate future, right? So we tend to think that the animals that are living now or that will live in, say, 5 years or 10 years are our focus. So it's as if they were far more important than those who will live later, those who will live, say, in 100 years. But it's completely unrealistic to think that you know, animal exploitation and speciesism and all that will end up, will disappear in just 10 or 20 years. I mean, this will go on, and animals will be affected by it in the following centuries. So when we think about these issues, we have to take all this in consideration, and we don't have to try to do that benefits more animals right now, or that benefits most animals in say 5 years or 10 years, but on the overall, right? So in order to see this, I think it's interesting to consider what has happened in the past. So for instance, if you consider what activists at the beginning of the 19th century, some of whom were actually against using animals, like, for instance, Louis Gompert. He avoided all animal products. He was a kind of proto-vegan, right? And he was nevertheless doing campaigns, I don't know, against the maltreatment of animals used for, I don't know, for transport, like horses and other things that probably were, this probably had a much significant impact in their time. But probably on the long term, if they had started to, you know, do things such as spreading concern for animals, including the eating and all that, probably, you know, the effect, the impact that they would have had would have been bigger 200 years later, right? So I think that just as we can see this when we look towards the well, not when we look, when we look backwards, we have to think in the same way when we look towards the future. So it's, I mean, I've been speaking for a long time now, but I guess that you can get an idea of what this thing with cognitive biases is about.
Yeah.
If you want, I can come up with another example or.
Well, I'll give a link to the full talk so people can go through that in terms of getting all of them.
Right.
I mean, obviously, there's a couple of points there. I mean, in some sense, it's kind of like a hard sell, I imagine. I mean, do activists kind of think that you're suggesting that they ignore things now for the sake of the future? Is that what they think you're saying?
I hope they don't think so, because that would be a bad way of interpreting the idea that I'm trying to express. Because sometimes, you know, to be able to spread that message that will help animals more in the long term, it's useful to tackle issues that are going on now. Like, for instance, suppose that the public is outraged about some particular way in which animals are abused, right? Which is maybe not representative at all. I mean, maybe many more animals are suffering in other ways. But, you know, in this particular case, you know, the attention of the public has been raised. So it seems intelligent then to try to approach this. So we somehow tackle this issue, but in such a way that allows us to present a much more wider and comprehensive case regarding the discrimination and the exploitation of animals. So, for instance, if you consider the case of bullfighting in countries such as Spain or in some countries in Latin America, I mean, this is something that most of the public opposes. Like, I don't know, for instance, in Spain, it's like 70% of the population or more are against bullfighting. And in other countries in which bullfights go on, this percentage is even higher. So they are likely to hear your message if they know that you are going to speak against bullfighting. But then the way in which you are going to speak against bullfighting is not the one they expect, because they may expect you to say, well, you know, this is cruel, or we shouldn't be doing this, but they aren't expecting you to say, well, you know, this is a consequence of our discrimination of non-human animals, because we act towards them as, you know, throughout history, people from European descent has been acting against the black people and so on. They don't expect you to speak about anti-speciesism, and they don't expect you to say that bullfighting is just like eating animals as food. So this means that in order to achieve this long-term goal, sometimes tackling these specific issues that are going on right now can be very useful. The thing is, of course, that that means that we have to tackle them in a very different way from that one which is sometimes tackled, right?
Yeah. And yeah, because you were saying effectively that you would say in Spain something like, well, you know, this is a speciesist practice. We're opposed to speciesism, so therefore we're opposed to this.
Right.
Which is,
right.
You know, in my translation, what I would have done is say that, you know, other animals are rights bearers, and what we do to them are rights violations. This is a rights violation, so therefore we're opposed to it. And as you say, it's about contextualization then, really, isn't it? And so, really, then, it would be, I mean, this is almost like tapping into the single issue question. It's really about getting the claims making right to go along with whatever you're doing at the time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, all these debates about single issues, when I hear the arguments for and against this, I sometimes feel that I agree with them, and I agree with some of the people presenting this case against single issues campaigns on some points. But then I think, well, but see, I think that you're right in this. But I think that in order to do this, you could take advantage of single issues in the way in which I have said before. I mean, I may make a campaign against bullfighting, or I may you know, attend a media debate on bullfighting. And I will do it because that is an advantage for me to have more people hearing about veganism, about the moral consideration of animals, about speciesism, or if you want, about the rights that should be recognized to animals.
Well, I agree with that, and so especially on that thing about there's always something to agree with in terms of the opposition to single issues. It's just that my experience is that animal advocates across the board seem to be very fond of them for whatever reason they are, and so you need to work with that in a way. So that's the issue. If we move then to you obviously talk about rejecting speciesism, and you describe your own position as anti-speciesist, and you say that's a move beyond veganism. Can you explain that part?
May I make a comment before we get into that about what you have just said?
Absolutely.
Okay, because I do think that I'm not going to say in most cases, but just to be cautious, but in many cases at least, probably most cases, but let's say in many cases at least, this that I mentioned before regarding how to take advantage of particular issues is not what animal advocates do, right? And this is probably because we all have, as I said before, a cognitive biases, and we should struggle against them. And many activists just have these biases, and because they have these biases, they focus against, I don't know, they focus on doing activism against fur, because they consider, well, fur is a very important issue, or against vivisection, say. But, you know, you must consider that the amount of animals that are, you know, killed in farms and killed in fish factories, and the amount of fish and other animals that are captured in the sea is, you know, very, it is many orders of magnitude bigger than other animals suffering in some particular forms of exploitation, such as fur or vivisection and so on, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I don't think that there is something special of the fact of being in a farm because they want to take your fur out of you, Something special going there on there. I don't think there is anything of the kind that is not going on in the case of another farm in which an animal is farmed, because they are gonna take their his or her flesh, right, out of he or she. So I think that there are biases going on here. So this is where all this speech about biases that we were, you know, addressing before gets into the whole picture, right? So having said this, we can go now and we can turn to this issue of speciesism and veganism. Okay, so to explain better what I think all this is about, we can consider what has happened in the case of the abolition of the slavery of African people, right? So throughout the 19th century, in different countries at a different time, I mean, this was a practice that was progressively abolished, but that didn't end. That wasn't the end of racism, right? So the same happens in the case of the exploitation of non-human animals. We can reach a society in which we are all vegan, in which we no longer exploit animals, but yet we are still speciesist, right? So I don't want that, because speciesism is wrong, is unjustified. So there is no reason to think that an interest is more important just because it's a human interest rather than the interest of another animal. So it is speciesism then that is my focus. And we should note that When I'm talk about this, I'm not only considering what may happen in the future once we are all vegan. I'm also concerned with what happens now, because I've seen many vegan people who are not concerned with speciesism at all. So, for instance, there are many vegan people who donate their money for NGOs who do things for humans. And they don't donate the same amount, say, to organizations that defend animals or non-human animals. So how can this be? Well, basically because they care more for humans than for animals. That's a fact, and that's speciesist. So we should be concerned with this too. This is what I think, and this is why I want to stress that veganism isn't enough, that we should move forward to anti-speciesism. And moreover, there is also the issue of doing things for others, not only refraining from harming others. So when we are talking about veganism, we are talking about ceasing to exploit animals, that is, to refrain from harming them. But when we are considering ethics applied to our relations to other humans, no one believes, or very few people believe, that they should be limited only to refraining from harming them. I mean, most people think that we also have moral obligations that concern how we should do things for them. So if someone is in need of help, we have a moral duty to help others. Moreover, this not only happens in the case of ethics, it also happens in the political realm. So states all around the world have not only have the role of making it the case that some citizens of that state don't harm others, but also they have duties towards citizens of those countries to grant them certain needs to be fulfilled. And this is what, for instance, the Declaration of Human Rights is about. In the Declaration of Human Rights, you can find things such as a right to education, to health, and to a number of things, right, that need to be positively addressed, right? So if we defend animal rights and we are not speciesist and we believe that the same concerns we have for humans, we should have them for other animals, which is clearly the anti-speciesist viewpoint, it seems, then we should be concerned not only with negative obligations towards animals, that is, from refraining from harming them, but also, just as it happens in the case of humans, with doing positive things for them and helping them when they need it.
Yeah. So this takes us into the potentially controversial issue then of intervention. Now, it was interesting in the sense that you showed in the in the lecture some examples where we already do intervene, like with vaccinations, etc. But then you also gave some examples of the migration of wildebeest and river crossings, and saying that we could help there in that sense. But then you had other issues like fishers, who most of them, and we're talking about thousands, will die as soon as they're born.
Yeah.
And maybe we could do something there. And you were saying then that obviously there would be kind of consequences of doing that. And I think that you're critical of those views, the animal rights views, that say, in a sense, that other animals are a different nation and just leave them alone. You're critical of that, and you think that we can intervene.
Yeah.
And then also deal with the consequences, right?
Yeah. Well, first of all, even if you assume that claim that other animals are nations, that doesn't change the fact that if they are in need, we would have a reason to help them. The best way to see this is considering what happens in the case of humans again. Even if humans live in different nations, when there is some, say, some humanitarian catastrophe in some of them, other nations which are in a position that allows them to help are kind of expected to help. So if they don't do that, we consider that they are failing to fulfill a humanitarian duty that they should have. So it's perfectly normal, if you consider human politics, to talk about some nations helping others, right? Even if we assume that animals are nations, because then we should consider what kind of nations there are, right? Chimpanzees one nation, and then, say, ants one nation, or these particular ants one nation and this other. I mean, it's kind of strange. I prefer to think that we are all, you know, involved, and we are all part of the same scenario, right? We are all living together, whether we like it or not. And it's impossible not to affect other animals. I mean, even if you're a vegan, you are eating vegetables that have to come from somewhere. And the place in which they were grown are places in which other animals are. So we are intervening all the time in nature, and we are intervening in the lives of animals all the time, right? So it's completely impossible to think that we can refrain from intervening. But then what we can think is, well, given that we are intervening, maybe we could consider a different way of intervening. So instead of living in a way that just takes our interests as the final aim, why not taking the interests of all sentient beings as our final aims, right? So in this way, just as we act to fulfill our needs or those of other humans, let's do the same for other animals. So if there are animals in need, well, let's help them if we can, provided, of course, that when we do it, we don't cause more harm. I mean, that's obviously...
But that obviously is going to be the problem. I mean, a conservationist would immediately start thinking about the predator-prey relationship. And going back to the wildebeest example, if you save the wildebeest, that means there's somebody not getting their dinner, presumably. You don't take a kind of transhumanist kind of position like David Pearce, right? So you're not talking about intervening on a kind of very micro level in nature, but just now and again, presumably. But that also has consequences, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So the thing is, we have to ponder the different interests of animals. For instance, in a recent debate with a defender of speciesism, he was making this point to me, saying, well, you know, if you think that, then you should be trying to help animals, and if you help these animals, then that may be harmful for other animals. So mm-hmm. What I reply to this person is, okay, but what if just set aside non-human animals for a moment and think about humans. Maybe if you help these humans, you will affect negatively these humans. But still, you will consider that it's worth it to help those humans. Or maybe because of this, you are not going to help those humans because you will affect more negatively these other humans. And that's what ethics is in many cases about. you have to ponder to consider the different interests of the different individuals who are involved and try to, do that which is best for all, if possible. And if not, well, try to help without harming others. I mean, you have to ponder it there. Having said this, I think that most people are very pessimistic about this, but that's because, not much debate on this has gone on thus far. So the main basics of how ecosystems work and how animals are harmed are not often tackled. So, for instance, if you consider that case, the case of helping these animals and these wallabies crossing from Tanzania to Kenya, well, the fact is that the dinner there wouldn't be really to predators, but mainly to those small animals and to bacteria and other microorganisms would feel in the rotting corpses, right? Moreover, there is also this thing that this argument saying, well, yeah, but even if these animals survive and no other animals eat them, because there are too many, eventually they will starve and so on. And, activists against hunting know that this isn't really quite so, because in many cases, when these animals reach a certain number and food is scarce, females get pregnant less often and so on, right?
Yeah.
And then there are many cases, many instances of like in national parks in which humans have provided animals with food when they were starving and really nothing, no catastrophe for these animals has happened at all, right? The thing is that when they do this, it's because they have some conservationist aim. They don't care for animals themselves. They care for the species, maybe. But nevertheless, this shows us that this can be done for the sake of the animals. It's just like in the case of vaccination that I think you were mentioning before. I mean, vaccination of wild animals has been on for decades now, and it's done mainly for our own interests, because we don't want these animals to pass diseases to ourselves or other animals we live with. But the case that we do this, even if it's just because just out of self-interest, shows us that it's possible to do it for the sake of the animals themselves.
Right, is when we're talking to the press. So this final issue then that we wanted to talk about is just like it was an aside really in your lecture, in the sense that you suddenly kind of told the audience that hang on a minute, there are a way of dealing with the media, which we ought to be, you said this is very important. And as a spokesperson who deals with the media, I think that's right. And you were saying essentially that don't go into an interview thinking that you have to answer the questions, right?
You don't go to an interview to do that. You go to an interview to make your point. So, it all depends on how the interview is. If it's live, then you should get there with a whole message developed in different parts, right? So depending on the question, you developed one part of your whole message. If it's not live, which is what happens in most of the times, so they are gonna speak with you for maybe 5 minutes, and then only 5 seconds of what you say will appear on TV or radio or whatever. Then you want to repeat all the way the same thing, because
so that means that whatever they use, it's going to be the same, isn't it?
Yeah. And because you don't have any obligation, any duties towards the interviewer, the journalist. Your concern is the animals, right? So you want to say that which is good for the animals. So whatever they ask you, come back to your points and make your points. And this is also important when you are debating someone. You should be focused on your points, not on the points that the other person wants to raise, right? So for instance, if you are discussing with someone about, I don't know, say hunting, as we say before, or, well, we've talked about hunts already. So given that before I said that we should focus on the whole thing, right? Suppose that you are discussing about, say, food with someone, about the ethics of eating animals. And this person is coming back all the way to issues having to do with health and with nutrition and all that. You definitely don't want a whole debate to focus on a discussion on nutrition. You want it to be focused on whether animals should be respected. So you come back to that all the time, no matter what they tell you. So if they tell you about how do vegans deal with, I don't know, whatever, B12. You say, well, you know, there are supplements and there are some foods that are enriched in these. So, well, some people may think this is uncomfortable, but we must bear in mind that the situation of animals is far more uncomfortable. And why should they be entitled to this? Because they can suffer as we do, blah, 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 blah. And it's the species. So you come back all the way to what you want to discuss about.
Yeah, it's particularly important also when you're doing what we were talking about before, which is contextualizing. So every answer should include some form of contextualization as well. Again, in case being an edited interview, that it's the only bit they use. So it always contains that. Because, yeah. I mean, I do know that, you know, from a social movement point of view, in a general sense, when people start to go on the media, they tend to like the taped and the recorded ones first, because if you make a mistake, you can do a take two.
Yeah.
When they get more proficient in what they do, they tend to like the live ones better, because then that means that the media can't edit you.
Absolutely.
So it's, yeah, that's an interesting kind of aspect of being on the media, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a problem, because maybe, I mean, you can have an interview that lasts 5 minutes and you spend 4 minutes and 50 seconds making your point, and then you spend 10 seconds tackling whatever other thing, a completely secondary issue, and you just make it because, you know, after 4 minutes and 50 seconds, you are tired, and, you know, you can see that the interviewer is getting maybe a bit angry or whatever, and impatient. So you feel kind of guilty, and then you, well, eventually say whatever else, and then those are going to be the 10 seconds that appear in the media, and you don't want that. So
yeah,
you have
right,
to resist.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they are incredibly proficient at using the bit that you most don't want them to. Going back to the Veggie Pride talk then, Oscar, finally, have you had any feedback from that particular presentation that you made?
Well, yeah, the discussion there was very interesting and quite open-minded. Actually, although a part of it is in the video. I mean, we then after that went on discussing, and people there were, as I said, very open-minded. Actually, to be honest, I made some criticism there of the very Veggie Pride itself, because I'm not sure about whether focusing an event about veganism on the discriminations that vegans rather than animals suffer is such a good idea. Mm. And also because, you know, it may not give a good impression to other people to say, well, see how bad we vegans are. We are discriminated against. Maybe it should be better to, you know, try to give a positive image of ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, for other reasons as well. And nevertheless, I mean, people weren't feeling bad about that, but rather very, very open, and we had a good discussion. And that's good, because we definitely need to discuss this strategic point, because whether we succeed or not in them is going to mean a lot to animals. So in saying this, I haven't responded your your question. Sorry about that. But I don't know.
You are talking about how to be a politician on the media. So you're just putting it into practice. Actually, just as an aside, Oscar, there might be something you could help me with, in the sense that it's been suggested that in mainland Europe at the moment, and I don't know whether this is an issue, maybe you do, that there is a bit of a slide towards arguing for vegetarianism. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about Veggie Pride, the actual name.
Yeah.
But, you know, this idea about talking about vegetarianism in order to talk about veganism. Are you kind of aware of this kind of suggestion that people are now starting to favor vegetarian as the title or whatever?
Well, first of all, I mean, there's some discussion about what the word vegetarian mean, right?
Yeah, right.
Because, I mean, this term was meant from the beginning to mean vegan. And it was only because some people who wanted to be called vegetarian but wanted to eat some animal products started to use it that eventually it ended up meaning something different. But
It's a bit late to reclaim it now, though, isn't it? Really, I suppose.
Probably. I don't know. It might be. I mean, I guess that if all vegans wanted to reclaim it, we would be able to do it because we are really strong in doing this. And for instance, well, maybe not in the not so much in places such as the UK or Ireland, because you have such a long story there. About all this, but in other places, like for instance in the Spanish-speaking world, it's very common to hear that expressions such as total vegetarian or real strict vegetarian in opposition to those who are vegetarians but eat dairy products and so on. So, but anyway, this is just an issue about linguistics, right? So. I'm kind of sympathetic towards the idea of reclaiming the word, but I'm also aware that it may be difficult to do this. So, but that's just, as I said, something having to do with the language. Then a completely different issue, or well, related issue, but a different one nevertheless, is that of saying, well, you know, you can first avoid these particular animal products, and then you can move on. So, yeah, as you say, I think that. In recent times, some people have been arguing for that. I don't know if it's something completely new, because it seems that it's something that every now and then appears as a kind of trend among some people. Well, as you can imagine, I don't agree with this because, well, for the reasons that you probably share, that many people just stop there, and it gives the impression that there are some ways of using animals that are better than others and all that, but I mean, I don't want to say this in a fanatical way, right? Because it may eventually be the case that encouraging people to avoid meat first and then other products ended up being a more efficient course of action to achieve highest number of vegans, right? I don't think so, and I haven't seen evidences of this yet. I think because no evidences have been produced, because this hasn't been studied.
Yeah, it needs some empirical research on this one.
Yeah, so I'm very reluctant to think that this works. But as I say, I'm not really a fanatic about this or any other thing. I mean, I'm open to change my views on this if I see evidences that these work. I mean. There is a point also regarding this, you know, the food on the door approach, right? That you should try to attract people with steps that are affordable to them, but this need not be necessarily by first stopping eating meat and then other products. Moreover, we should also note that when people think about these small steps. They think basically about giving up beef or you know pig flesh and calf's flesh and all that.
Red meat and all that. Yeah,
that's it. Big animals, and that may mean that they end up eating many more small animals such as fishes.
Chicken and fishes. Yes. Yeah.
Which, because they are so small, I mean, they will kill many, many more animals. So this may be counterproductive. Moreover, there is also a concern. I would also like to express my concern with in the case of eggs, because although sometimes we've all heard this expression that says that there's more cruelty in a glass of milk than in a piece of meat, right? The thing is that if you study the impact in animal lives, not only in the suffering that they undergo, but also in the deprivation of their lives and so on, that animals suffer when you consider different animal products. Well, the fact is that milk and then red meat score relatively low there, whereas chicken meat and eggs score quite high. I mean, not as high as certain fishes, but still pretty high. So if you eat eggs, you're going to be harming animals far more than if you eat beef, right? So this is another concern that I have. But as I said, I mean, because it's apart from this effect on animals, there are also strategical considerations. So to stress what I said before, I mean, I'm very skeptical about whether this is going to work, but I'm open to see evidences on the contrary.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's an interesting thing, isn't it, that taking on evidences, because one of the things you said actually in your talk is that a lot of people do certain things because they like to do certain things. Now, if we get evidence that that's not the optimal thing to do, that's suboptimal, would we change? That's the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, Tim Geyer of AR Zone made that challenge, I remember it a couple of years ago, saying that, you know, if we got evidence that doing something that we don't like to do actually worked, would we do it? Because there would be a tension then, right?
Yeah. And I think Tim was completely right there. He made a very good point. Yes, as I said, I mean, most of us want to be right, right? So accepting that you were wrong is something hard. In particular, if you have been doing that for many years, that's one reason why it's so hard to, you know, convert people into veganism or anti-speciesism when they are older, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm always very careful to not try to keep talking about in the 1980s we used to, and like there are some people who kind of do that. And just because it worked then doesn't mean it's even relevant now. And I think, you know, the ones who are a little bit older in the tooth need to remember that as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that it's good also to, I mean, we should give up trying to convert those who are in their 70s or in their 80s and so on, right? But in the 90s maybe, who knows? But being realistic is going to be more difficult than doing it in the case of those who are in their 20s or so.
Well, my own mother actually went vegan in her 60s, so she's a case in point. But I think that was a networking thing, the fact that the members of the family that she was interacting with all the time were vegans at the time, so it was easier for her to do it in the end. So I think that explained that. Going back to the feedback, just very kind of final on this. You mentioned that people were asking interesting questions and engaging. It's sometimes quite frustrating that you get a lecture on YouTube or on the internet, and they don't include the Q&A. That's always very frustrating to me, because sometimes the Q&A is just as good, if not better, than the original lecture. So presumably that Q&A wasn't recorded, is that right?
I don't remember yet, because also there is another version of it that I think is going to come up soon, because they asked me to send them the PowerPoint presentation. So I don't know if they will include it or not.
Oh, yeah, the famous presentation which nobody could see.
That one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, I'm hoping then that we've been able to pique people's interest in watching the entire thing, and especially if they've also got access to the PowerPoint, which will make it even better. And we need to start using that technology. There is technology now where you can see the speaker, but you can also see the PowerPoint, and they kind of merge together. I think it's called lecture capture or something. And we need to start doing that, because that makes watching things online much better. But I hope people are interested in watching the entire thing now. And an easy way of finding it, you go to YouTube, just put in Oscar Horter About Strategies or Oscar Horter Strategies, and you'll get it. I'll put the link on the website, on the podcast link as well. So it's been great speaking to you, Oscar. Thanks so much for your time. And I wish you well for the future.
Well, thanks a lot, and well, congratulations on your work. And yeah, thanks for this opportunity to speak about biases and all that. I hope this was helpful in any way. I don't know if it was, but if
It certainly was, and I learned a great lesson in how to dodge questions and just say what you wanted to say in the first place. So,
yeah, well, I tried to simplify that myself in not asking what you were wanting me to answer.
absolutely, put it into practice.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I just hope that people that I just hope that this may encourage people to think twice. I mean, people sometimes can get very angry with when others don't understand what animal rights are about is about or what speciesism is about. Well, so then try to put yourself in their place when you are considering other biases that you may have, such as the ones we spoke about before. So that's it.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right there in the sense that, even when you see interaction on Facebook, there's a lot of position defending rather than position analyzing that goes on, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. You're very right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's for another time, and you would be welcome back at any time you like, Oscar. But for now, thanks very much, and have a great rest of the day.
Okay, thank you, Roger.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, so there we go. The conversation with Oscar Horta, Professor of Philosophy, and I hope you get a lot out of that. The cliche that I hope you get as much as I did from recording it. Now, I will put together. Do encourage you to look at the full version. YouTube, Oscar Horta strategies or about strategies. I will put the link on the podcast. Now, the podcast is obviously recorded by Skype, so there was a couple of technical issues there. We lost it a little bit in the middle, so that accounts for the break. And also, there's a couple of recurring echo issues, but I don't think it's a great deal. And I think it hangs together fairly well. Okay, so we're at that point then, the point that we've all been waiting for, of course, the boring old fart who, as a boy, wanted to be a DJ and didn't have the brains to get together like John Peel. Go over to North America, put on a Liverpudlian accent, and become famous. Spot. So, I don't have many philosophers on my show. I've had some, but not many, and so this gives me the perfect opportunity to play this.
Him and your camp was a real piss act, who's very rarely stable. Odd Digger was a busy beggar, who could think you under the table. Time that you could have consumed with on Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swan, who's just as sloshed as Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill of his own free will, on hot wine and shandy, was particularly ill. Plato, they say, could sing it away, half a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle, Hobbes was fond of his dram. And René Descartes was a drunken fart, I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thinker, but a bugger when he's pissed.